From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The two sisters at the center of Rise and Shine, Anna Quinlan's latest novel, maintain a tight friendship even while leading very different lives. Bridget, the narrator, is a social worker in the Bronx, while Megan is the wildly popular and highly regarded host of America's top-rated morning news show. And then Megan does something silly. She makes an offhanded remark on the air that causes a scandal. Rise and Shine from Random House is Anna Quinlan's fifth novel. She's also written quite a bit of nonfiction, some children's books. She's won a Pulitzer Prize from when she was an op-ed writer at the New York Times, and now she writes a biweekly column for Newsweek, and I'm pleased to welcome her back to my show today. Hello.
And I'm pleased to be back.
Now, Megan Fitzmaurice has, or do you say Fitzmaurice?
Fitzmaurice.
Has hosted the top-rated morning show in the country for 10 years, and everybody's just going to think Katie Couric. No?
I don't know why you wouldn't think Diane Sawyer or why you wouldn't think,
Because Katie Couric is more likely to do this.
One of the things that I'm always struck by when people make those connections is that for some reason, Americans don't believe in fiction anymore. Maybe it's because our real-life news is so much stranger than fiction that we assume everything must be a clef.
Yeah, but everything is inspired by something. One day you sat down and you said, well, what happens if somebody does one of those shows? And the minute you're doing that, you're somehow thinking about people who do those shows.
Actually, I think you started a much more general and somewhat vaguer place, Leonard, which is you say, in a celebrity culture, what happens if someone takes a sudden slide down that celebrity slope? And that's really what I thought about. I was thinking a lot about appearance and reality, about how we live in a country now in which, it doesn't matter whether you're happy in the McMansion. It doesn't matter whether the McMansion is mortgaged to the hilt. The McMansion suggests somehow a level of achievement or contentment that one ought to aspire to. And as I thought about that, I thought about that slippery slope of fame. And when I started to think about what it is that makes you famous in this country, visual identity is key. It's that ability of people to stop dead on the sidewalk and say, oh, my God, you're whatever. It's really interesting when you're not visually identifiable because sometimes it comes in a different package. I remember someone telling me once that they'd heard Terry Gross speak at a grocery store or something, and their head snapped up, and anyone hearing your voice every day would identify the voice, but that visual identity is what makes people famous. And eventually, I came around to the morning show thing. It wasn't my first thought.
Well, who do you tend to identify with more, your narrator, Bridget, the social worker, or Megan, the broadcast star? After all, you are a celebrity in your own right, and I'm sure people recognize you on the street.
They don't so much, actually, but it's interesting. I sort of think that if you took a cleaver down the middle of my personality, my inclinations, my understanding, and the facts of my daily life, you'd have Bridget on one side and Megan on the other. I have lived this kind of public life in some sense, but I am the kind of ubiquitous watcher that Bridget is, if only because I've been a reporter my whole life.
If you cleave New York City down the middle, you also come up with the two worlds of this novel.
Exactly. And that was something that I've written about so much as a journalist, but I've never done in a novel. It was such a rich vein because it's not just obviously that we're a city of stupendous wealth and really grinding poverty. It's that sometimes stupendous wealth and grinding poverty are a block apart, two blocks apart.
Or a short subway ride.
Exactly. And also that sometimes it seems as though the two groups don't even know that one another exists.
Are they living in separate bubbles?
At some level, they're living in separate cities. I think sometimes the entitlement of one group and the just the requirements of daily life for the other just have no reality to one another.
Well, early on, while Megan is prepping for a segment on Tupperware, she says to Bridget, "You just make me feel like my life is absurd." And Bridget replies, "That's so condescending. What? Suffering is always real and success is always fake?" So Bridget does understand.
Right.
She's not being judged, but somebody in this business who often will do things we would prefer not to do because that's part of the job and it's part of maintaining celebrity will often feel judged by somebody who they think is doing something more important.
There's no question about it. And the other thing is that they feel when you're doing well, you may have serious issues and problems. But when you compare and contrast them, which is what Megan's doing in that passage, with those of the have-nots, you somehow are contemptuous of your own issues. And I think that's something that you see here, that Megan has serious, serious problems with what she does and with where her life is going. But, you know, even her own sister, who loves her so much and is so loyal to her, will say, "Yeah, but you make $10 million a year." Well, it is possible to have a loss of faith and face at $10 million a year, as well as, you know, on public assistance.
My guest is Anna Quinlan, whose latest novel is Rise and Shine. It's published by Random House. Does that come as a surprise because you were a journalist, wrote mostly about politics, sometimes about personal issues, and then suddenly you have this other career, not only as a writer of fiction, but a very successful writer of fiction? You've written a number of bestsellers.
Does it come as a surprise to me that I was able to do
it? Well, that it happened and that you're now in this situation where you just slide between a whole bunch of worlds, or do you see it as all being part of the same thing?
At some level, I think of it as all writing. I mean, you know, all writing requires the same sort of thought and discipline and a certain kind of voice and that kind of thing. On the other hand, there's such a nice balance to each other. You know, the column, you get that kind of immediate gratification, especially now with the internet. I mean, I have my hate mail literally 24 hours after I filed a column. And you have that deferred gratification with a novel that can be really terrifying. I just feel really lucky that it turned out this way, especially because my original career goal was to be a novelist. I sort of went into journalism accidentally and then realized that it was just so great that I stayed on.
Now, I find it interesting that you talk about the hate mail. I'm sure you get a fair amount of mail that says, "Anna, I couldn't have said it better myself. I agree with you 100%. But I'll bet that all those things don't mean a heck of a lot to you, but that one really angry letter that tells you you should die, it really gets to you."
Actually, I think the balance is a little different than that, and I've known it ever since I was first a columnist at the Times. I think if people really like what you've written, they finish reading it and think, "Wow, she's terrific," and they push the paper aside. If they really hate what you've written, they write a letter. So that lots of times the balance of your mail doesn't really tell you about the reaction to the column.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, after all these years, I mean, I started on the op-ed page in 1990. Hate mail puts a lot less of a dent in my armor than it once did.
In this story, Megan issues this profanity because she's upset with something that's happened that her guest has done in his life. But would somebody, an experienced broadcaster, slip that far?
You know, it's interesting. I had a long discussion about this this morning before I went on the air, Good Morning America. And some of the tech guys were talking about how careful you have to be with your mic. And in fact, just yesterday, there was an incident in which an on-air person at CNN had her mic on, and instead of hearing President Bush's remarks, you were hearing her talking about her sister-in-law, her husband, and other assorted issues until somebody finally pulled the plug on her.
It almost sounds like the subject of another novel.
I mean, she's so... I think Megan is so rattled because of things going on in her personal life that morning. And of course, you know, there's some question about whether her mic might have been intentionally left open. And the other thing that's so troubling is what she says about this guy she's just finished interviewing.
Ben Greenstreet.
Yeah, is completely and utterly accurate. In other words, sitting at home, it's exactly what you'd say about this idiot. But of course... First of all, the FCC won't let you say certain things on the air. And second of all, in television, we're still supposed to make nice at some level.
And that is a comment on the ethics of television. She may be disgusted by Ben Greenstreet's behavior, but she's also taken the time to interview him.
Right, right. And actually taken the time to get the get. I mean, the whole point is in this story, in this seamy story about Ben Greenstreet and his wife, somebody's gotten the wife's divorce lawyer and somebody's gotten the husband of the person who's involved in the affair. But Megan, because she's number one, has gotten Ben Greenstreet himself. I mean, it's clear at some level that she's contemptuous of her own job, at the same time that it's a job that America thinks is so wonderful that saying you were going to leave it behind would be unthinkable.
We've seen any number of instances where people have said the inappropriate thing, including the president himself,
right,
a number of times. It didn't hurt him when he and Dick Cheney said something about a New York Times reporter, but the Blair spillover, and then Ronald Reagan when he said we pushed the button and the Soviet Union is going to be obliterated or something like that. We are kind of shocked that people who have these public persona suddenly reveal themselves in ways that may not always be admirable.
You know, I'm not sure that we're shocked.
I mean, don't we think they're normal?
Language.
They're just normal
people.
But
we're shocked that they didn't know the mic was open. Yeah. It's more about that. It's more about being careful than it is about being clean.
Now, because you have a strong political side, you write political commentary in Newsweek. Do you feel that sensibility comes into a novel like this? This is a post 9/11. Novel takes place in New York. How much was politics on your mind when you were writing the book?
I don't know if I would call it politics, but I've written more than a few times about what I've called the stations of the cross that we make the poor undertake to get any kind of help in their daily lives. And I really wanted to make that vivid in this novel, that we think of ourselves as a good and charitable society, but the truth of the matter is that we're either blind or quietly disdainful of the have-nots at some level. And I really wanted to make that clear in this novel, not only by showing it, but by making very vivid and human the often very good, very smart, and very interesting people who are put through this particular treadmill because of the circumstances in which they live.
Do you have another book already in mind? How long before you go from one novel to the next?
I usually wait until after book tour just because I know that if I start something, then I'm going to lose a month or 6 weeks, and that really upsets the forward motion for me. So I would imagine in about... I have a lot of people walking around in my head right now, but I'm not going to serve them until about the middle of October.
Do characters that you wrote in the past still walk in your head? Will Bridget's voice suddenly pop up one day?
You know, it's funny. I usually think of this as I live in a town, I make friends in a town, I know the lay of the land, and then I move out of the town. Mm-hmm. And often I move on pretty convincingly. For some reason, Megan and Bridget seem to be living with me longer, and I think maybe it's because, in this case, I do live full-time in the town in which they live, and that's the city of New York.
But that's a change for you as well. For a long time, you lived in New Jersey. You described yourself as somebody who lived near New York,
right,
but not in New York.
Right.
And that was an important way of seeing yourself. You wrote about people like that.
Right. Well, I still write about people who don't live in New York, and I still use my travels as a way to remind myself that New York is not the world. But when Bridget says the reason I live in New York is because it's the center of the universe, to some extent she's channeling Anna.
You're going to get more hate mail if you write that in Newsweek. Anna Quinlan's latest novel is Rise and Shine. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for coming by again.
It's my pleasure. And I got to say something. We write all the time about the dumbing down of the media, but there's a lot of the moving up of the media, and it's particularly clear here. There's always an intelligent discussion.
Oh, thank you so much, Anna. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.